I started to talk about. That is to say, the one that is connected to the democratic impulse rather than to a Christian conservatism. It does not mean self-hate, even when Jews like Marx, let us say, or Moses Hess, joined in with it. Forever, as I said in the last period, this anti-Semitism is integrated to a larger, in this case, socialist view of the world, and it will remain so, and pretty constant through Trotsky and Lenin as well. The idea is, of course, an attack on religion, and that is to be sure. But the Jewish religion here is closely linked to the commercial nature, to the fetishism of goods, to the finance capitalism that I talked about last time. This, of course, will also fuse very easily with romanticism and nationalism, both which were also anti-capitalist, anti-finance capitalist, in their democratic guise. The whole point is that anti-Semitism became a deep ingredient in modern mass movements of the left and of the right in an age of mass politics. And as I go on, I think this is something worth remembering, because it is actually the reason for the lasting of anti-Semitism. Why did anti-Semitism last? Why does it last? Why has it lasted? There are for this real historical reasons. I would say the early historical reason is Christianity and Christian theology. The reason that comes to the fore now is the connection of anti-Semitism with modern politics and modern mass movements. Those are the reasons that anti-Semitism has lasted. They are not written in the stars, but they are concrete historical reasons. What we must be concerned with, therefore, that anti-Semitism became in this way an ingredient, and in the end, a necessary ingredient to a modern mass movement, and intimately tied up, therefore, with modern mass politics, and as all modern politics, in mass politics, anti-Semitism became as firmly built in to modern politics as you will see, as it was built in to Christian theology. Let us take now some concrete examples, for I have been talking in very general terms. Let us first see the first serious anti-Jewish riots after emancipation, the riots of 1819, which spread throughout Germany. And these are very typical, and it will be a pattern that will continue. The riots started at Würzburg, the region, you don't know where this is anyhow, but the region isn't that important. How many people know where Würzburg is? One. And there are some graduate students in here who passed their prelims. I must say, we're really getting stopped all over. It began at the University of Würzburg, which is in south central Germany. And it began, typically enough, with students. It began as a student riot against an older professor who had done two things in his lecture. He had made favorable remarks about the Enlightenment and favorable remarks about the Jews. Once the riot started at the university against this professor, the petty bourgeoisie joined in. Jewish shops were plundered. In the end, others joined in, for it was free day to plunder. Soldiers had to restore order, Council asked for the expulsion of all Jews. They were with the students in this case. The expulsion of all Jews. This pattern is important because the mix of will remain. It is an important mix for the future. A mix of youth, in this case, nationalist youth, of economic rivalry, the petty bourgeoisie which joins in, a mix of democracy, for in a sense these riots condemned all privilege, and a basic thrust against the Enlightenment rationalism. These riots spread, and by 1920, especially in the community of Frankfurt, they have become known as the Hep-Hep riots. Hep-Hep was the traditional shout against Jews. What Hep-Hep means is very simple to explain. Jerusalemita est perdita. Jerusalem is lost. Jerusalemita est perdita. If you contract it, make Hep. And Hep remains, from the Middle Ages to modern times, the shout against Jews, both individual Jews on the street and in mass riots. It was the slogan, the traditional slogan, which has, of course, a Christian faith in this case. Jerusalemita est perdita, Jerusalem is lost. The riots are known, therefore, as the Hep-Hep riots of 1819, or the Hep-Hep riots of 1840 as well. The student phenomenon will accompany us up to 1933 and even later. Throughout Central Europe, especially, the student movement became involved from the very beginning of the century, both with nationalism and democracy. This was the founding of the fraternity system in 1811, the founding of the Gymnast Association. All had these overtones, both democratic and nationalistic, both of these. Yet, as we shall see, Jews were not wholly excluded, not from the fraternities until the end of the century. This mix that I have just talked about can be illustrated again on another level. For the mix is both nationalism, democracy, anti-capitalism, youth, and we must add philosophy. For eventually, of course, this was bound to get its own new and modern anti-Semitic philosophy. The man who founded it can well explain to us this kind of mix somewhat further. Jakob Fries was in fact the favorite student of Kant. Kant's favorite student, Kant's most eminent disciple. Unlike Kant, Fries was a passionate democrat. And it was this disciple of Kant, this democrat, who really laid the foundations for a new kind of philosophy of anti-Semitism, which took in this entire mix. But it is typical, on one level, that this impassioned democrat was one of the two chief speakers at a very famous festival, the Wartburg Festival of the Students' Organization. This festival, which you will read about in the Crisis book, so I don't have to go into it much deeper here, except mentioning. The Wartburg Festival of 1870 was a national festival by the student organizations, at the Wartburg with its Germanic Lutheran Association, a festival in which there was singing, but also the burning of books. That is the burning of books against nationalism, against democracy. Here again, the distinction between left and right is difficult to maintain. Fries's fellow speaker was none other than Jahn, the founder of the fraternity system and much else in German nationalism. Jahn, whom you will read about in the Crisis book, was his fellow speaker. And indeed, Fries's whole theory was very similar to everything that we have studied. Fries believed in a revival of the categorical imperative. Obviously, he was a Kantian, a disciple of Kant. But he believed that this must come from the people themselves, from below. And that was hindering the revival of human goodness and the categorical imperative was the government of the reaction, any kind of government. He was therefore a democrat. That is to say, he believed in universal suffrage. He believed in self-government and in all of that. From this, the Jews were excluded. For the Jews are, by definition, exploiters of other men. After all, the fetishism of goods, the finance capitalism, made for this result. Jews are exploiters. They cannot be excluded. In France, in the 1830s, we have again the anti-capitalist and anti-Jewish theme intertwined, which you have also, if you like, in Marx. Left and right are difficult here to set apart. Let me make this quite specific, because it will be of vast importance for the future. First of all, both left and right, by which I mean the coming socialism and nationalism, share a view of the Jew as the exploiter, as the conspirator of finance capitalism, as the man of the fetishism of goods, as, in other words, the medieval usurer writ large. This they share. There is no difference between Fries, who became a socialist, a young Hegelian, and then a socialist. Not much difference. And Karl Marx and Father Jahn. On this, they would agree across the board. First. Second, what is then the emerging difference between the socialist or young Hegelian and the nationalist? That difference only begins to emerge after 1850. And that difference is this. For the left, the Jewish question could be solved by The Vanity of the Jew, a book to which we shall come, the only communist book ever written on the Jewish question, published in the 1920s, is called The Vanishing of the Jew, Radical Assimilation. And you must say that the vanishing of the Jew here also means the vanishing of the Christian. But especially it means the vanishing of the Jew, clearly. That is to say, if you like, radical assimilation. Don't push to its ultimate extent. For the nationalist, this was really never the case. A German, or an Austrian German, or a Frenchman, was defined by culture and language. And here most Jews were in fact excluded, though some could always join. We shall come to that. If you had the right looks, that is the right stereotype, and I now talk in nationalist terms, if you had the right soul, you could join. Not racism yet. We are joy. And eventually we come to Jews who did joy. So that was possible always in nationalism. But nationalism never could accept the radical assimilation, because for it, most Jews were excluded. You had to have a German soul, you had to have a German appearance, or Austrian or French. You can do that to any nation. And if you didn't, then of course you were excluded. And I point out to you, excluded without a solution. For the socialists, the solution is there. The Jew vanishes. Eventually he vanished to Birobidzhan. We'll come to that. The Jew vanishes, as a communist tract puts it, a Leninist tract puts it, of the 1920s. The Jew will finally have horny hands, hands with blisters, though he will still gesticulate. That's the Leninist view of the Jewish question in one nutshell. But it can be, after all, finally abolished. It can be abolished. That's the point. For the nationalists, there was always a difficulty. What to do with the Jews? That difficulty wasn't there for the left, but it was always there for the nationalists. And that will be a very important thing indeed. In the anti-Jewish riots of 1819, as well as in the ones in 1844, the two main anti-Jewish riots of the period with which we are now concerned, which runs to mid-century, the economic situation played an important but not a simple part. The lifting of the continental blockade against England in 1815 had produced the economic crisis of 1819, together with bad harvests in 1816 and 17. But the problem is that you now have, in these first Jewish riots, the Hep riots, an economic crisis produced by the lifting of the continental blockade much earlier. But the problem is that without a reality, it would not have worked. The Jew was indeed the middleman. His economic distribution was in marginal economic activity and in high finance. There were, on the one hand, the Rothschilds, and on the other hand, the Hessian cattle dealers. What I'm saying is that the Jews economically had high visibility, so that the economic crisis does play into it, but not simply. For we must now, for a minute, see how these mobs behave, because that is central as far as the Jews were concerned. How did these mobs behave? And that is also bound up with the economic crisis. Now, the great studies of crowds, which we have, and which some of you have read, I'm sure, are by George Roudet. And George Roudet's thesis about crowds is as follows: that there are certain self-evident things about a rioting crowd, which for him would be evident in the French Revolution and in the anti-Jewish riots. Grain riots, for example, riots against grain shortage, tend to take place on market day and are directed against the millers and the grain merchants. The crowds he deals with are 18th century crowds. But Roudet believes essentially in the rationalism of crowds. He has to. He's a Marxist. So, quite obvious, you have to believe in the rationalism of crowds. That is to say, not only that the crowds knew what they wanted, but they also went about it in a rational way. Grain riots come on market day. They're directed against grain merchants. All this makes a great deal of sense. Unfortunately, all of Roudet has just been thrown out of the window by the research of Mr. Cobb, in a very important book on the police in France during the revolution. And it seems to be true that, as a matter of fact, the correspondences of a crowd are not that simple. If the correspondence of a crowd, action of a crowd, were as simple as Roudet tells us, then the Jews would rather be well off, because the crowd would go against the grain traders, which in many regions the Jews were called, against the millers, which the Jews were, or whatever else is the issue at the moment. In Roudet's ideas, there's none of any explanation why crowds are directed against Jews. But if you examine, let us say, these Hep-Hep riots of 1819, you come upon a realization. What is that realization? That symbols are much more important for a crowd than reality. That should really not greatly astonish, because the crowd that rioted for a hunger riot, really, in the French Revolution, in the end stormed the Bastille, and there was no grain in the Bastille. It wasn't a grain storage area. So in other words, what is important for crowds is, in effect, the symbolism which awakens them to action, the symbolism on which they can, in a way, play their demoniac qualities. Now, by the symbolism of the Jews, this is now very important, for again, all modern politics is mass politics, and therefore what the masses are must concern us. If anti-Semitism became an essential ingredient of modern mass movement, then it became so on the level of symbol, on the level of symbol for the masses. This I don't have to explain any longer. You know it from contemporary action. The kind of thing the masses goes after is symbolic. It may have nothing to do with the reality, but it is a symbol that in a way awakens them, that gets them going. But it may have nothing to do with reality. I don't want to be so contemporary, but obviously such symbols have several qualities. They have to be general, but they also have to exist. They have to be both general, but also specific. You have to have a specific target, because you cannot arouse the mass against the generality. That's it. You have to have a specific target. And secondly, it has to have some connection with a historical memory, as we say, with activating the subconscious. It has to have some connection with this, in one way or another, or it won't work. You can, if you like, figure this out from your own lives. Why do you storm the Mars Research Center? It's all the same kind of symbol, because everything it attends is symbol and has nothing to do, really, with the reality a great deal. But I suggest to you that monster of corporate capitalism will not activate anymore unless you have a good symbol for it. You have to have a good and concrete symbol. You have, in other words, to have a Bastille to storm. Ha, ha, I know, we don't have many. Nevertheless, I'm not concerned with this at the moment. The Jews were singled out. Whether they were involved in grain shortages or not, they became symbols. Now why? There are several reasons, and again it ties in with what I have said. First of all, the Jews existed. And I don't mean this in any joking form. And they existed separate, because emancipation was new, and the Jews of Eastern Europe were visible. In other words, they existed as a separate entity, most of them even with separate dress and separate, with the usual features. But it seemed to them, anyway, a matter of separation, both by dress and otherwise. Second of all, it was a generalized symbol, because what it actually meant are several things. It is a symbol that appeals to historical memory, first of all, because the Jews as Antichrist is learned in catechism. And unlike you, everybody had been to Sunday school. Everybody had learned the catechism. That's sometimes forgotten. So, in the catechism, they knew already that the Jews had not only killed Christ, but rejoiced. I'll come back to that in a little moment. That they knew already. This is the historical memory. But secondly, they also knew that such a people, separate in their mind, who is damned at Easter Mass, and otherwise, phrase I cited, is also a people of conspiracy. And here it was, of course, connected again with finance capitalism, with usury, the ancient anti-Jewish accusation, which was, of course, true. With usury, Jews were moneylenders, and the high economic visibility. All this made Jews into a symbol which fulfilled every part of the kind of symbolism that you need to arouse the masses. The anti-capitalist longings, the longings for change, could here be focused. Crowd action then needs activating of the subconscious, historical memories and associations. The Antichrist, even in secularization, to be sure, and I must make that clear again, the Christian inhibitions were removed, except for conservative anti-Semitism that I talked about last time. The inhibitions were removed. The basic prejudice was always there, from the catechism, from the mass, the basic thing. After all they read about the rage of the Jews against Christ, to which Pilate gave in. The normative passage here is the Epistle of St. John, chapter 19. That is the normative passage. That is the passage of the grassroots of anti-Semitism. If I were to give you one passage for the grassroots of this anti-Semitism, then please look at the Epistle of St. John, chapter 19, or at the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 13. In the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 13, it is the Jews who stoned St. Paul, and Calvin adds in his important commentary, told nothing but lies. Now it is obvious that this kind of catechism, this kind of Bible, this kind of basic Christianity played a big role in the popular imagination. It could not help so. This is all that most people ever read. So obviously it played, I dare say it still does play, a great part in the popular imagination. But several things have happened. First of all, this is now merely a base, a historical memory, a subconscious base in many times. The other is now secularized, with the Jew as the exploiter. The second thing that has happened is that all this has become connected to mass movement. Not only mass riots, as we shall see, mass riots first, but mass movements. For against Trudeau's interpretation, we find quite clearly that whatever the cause, from the 16th century on and before, it is the Jews whom the popular fury goes for first. Not the people who may actually be guilty, but the Jews. Economic reasons? Yes, moneylenders, so on. But very often, like in Würzburg, not really the reasons or whatsoever. This again has to do then with the vanishing impulse of the Enlightenment. For remember that at Würzburg, the old professor had been not only kind to the Jews, but to the Enlightenment. And that today, in the 1830s on, for youth, especially for student youth, conflicted with their essentially anti-rational revolt, whether they were early socialists or indeed nationalists, really does not matter. The problem for Jews from the beginning was that their emancipation was tied to rationalism and liberalism. And as the mass movements, nationalism, socialism, were opposed to a certain degree to rationalism and in every way to liberalism, the Jews from the beginning of emancipation had gone aboard the wrong train. Their train remained in the station. The other trains took off. This again is of vast importance, for it will be the Jewish bourgeoisie which almost alone upheld the tradition of rationalism and liberalism by the 1920s. You study Sigmund Freud sometime. It's a very good example of that. That's what Freud is all about. Upholding, we'll talk about it, that's all he is all about. Because his psychoanalysis comes from his social position and his ideological position. Here was a man who upheld, no matter what, liberalism. The state is a legal state. Repression is necessary in order to adjust to the laws. Who upheld that? Who upheld rationalism? The idea is to adjust the ego to what he thought was a rational society. The last. And even Freud in the end was quite isolated. That's why there are hardly any Freudians around who still believe in Freud, in the real Freud. There can't be. Freud's whole world picture doesn't exist, or it exists only in America, where some still uphold the wonderful ideas of rationalism and liberalism, I should then well hope. That's your heritage. If you don't uphold these ideas, you're in trouble as Jews. You're in big trouble as for the only ideas that have made Jewish existence possible in the West are in fact the ideas of liberalism and rationalism. And don't you forget it. You do forget it. You will forget it. Never mind. You'll forget it and history will go on as usual. Well, now the attacks, therefore, the attacks on liberalism and rationalism are attacks on Jews as Jews. That must be clear. But I also want to make it clear that until the 1880s, the individual Jew could always be an exception. We are not yet in any way in racial times. We are not yet in any way there. Now, what I have talked about is the growth of such anti-Semitic attitudes. What I must do now is again be specific. What I have done up to now is to try and explain to you, and you have questions on Friday, how this became connected with mass meetings, the importance of the symbolism, the importance of the Jewish stereotype. But we must now see what were the specific accusations. For language is important, and the specific accusation will be of vast importance for the future and will deepen what I have said. For in the end, the Jew became a stereotype. That is to say, a type both that was known, if you like, both internally and physically. So what we must talk about now, in a sense, is the actual accusations must say something about the arising of the Jewish stereotype. For that is something new. That is something new. I've told you already, no Jewish nose before the 18th century. None. No other Jewish features before the 18th century. There are reasons for that. And the reasons that make the emergence of the Jewish type are clear. Now, I know I'm again running into an obstacle. You have adopted, all of us have adopted, from this development a phrase, which you use, I bet, as well as I have used it, unfortunately, now and then. You say, somebody looks Jewish. Impossible before the 19th century. Wouldn't have been said. Didn't exist. It's a result of a developing stereotype in a century when many stereotypes developed. What then about the accusation? The basic accusation that goes with this anti-Semitism is that the Jew forms a state within a state. What is the genesis of this accusation? Because we can learn something when we look into the genesis of these matters. The formula was first used against the Freemasons because of their secrecy in the 18th century. It was then used in the 18th century against the Jesuits. For the Jesuits, remember, the 18th century disapproved of, they were a secret organization, therefore they were a state within a state. Just as the Freemasons seem to be a state within a state. These were serious accusations at a time of rising nationalism. At the end of the 18th century, with emancipation, please learn to think a little dialectically, with emancipation, that was now transferred to the Jews. The Jews were thought to be a state within a state. It was Fichte who first put this forward. For the idea was, of course, that the Jew, if he really wants to be a citizen, must not have a separate group existence. That a separate group existence would be absurd. So the first accusation runs as follows, and I want to contrast it. This is what is said in France. This follows doom. This is what was said by the National Assembly in France in that accusation in 1789. Everything should be denied to the Jews as a nation. Everything should be granted to them as individuals. They are obliged to become citizens. Some argue they do not want to be. Let them say this themselves, and let them then be expelled. It is impossible for them to be a nation within a nation. This summarizes, though, this summarizes for you once again almost everything I have said. Now, all right, this is enlightenment. Easy to get around it, easy to get around it to become a citizen. You do, you react, you accept the terms of the enlightenment. All right, again I run into flag. You say, what's wrong with it? Remember, these people wanted to accept these terms. The accusation was a very difficult accusation, and a very basic one, a very basic one. But look how it changed. By the end of the century, the same accusation is now made. But look at the change talk. Look what has happened. As for those, talking about the Jews, as for those who will prefer to remain for any reason whatever, in our midst, in Europe, they must from now on cease constituting a state within a state. They must forego their dreams of absolute dominion. Let them honestly make their peace with Christian civilization. Let them assimilate with us. Let them merge with us and become one with us in body and soul, a single nation. Now look at the change tone. It is now an aggressive tone, obvious. It is assumed now, as neither Dole nor anybody else assumed, that a state within a state means domination, that this is a part of the Jewish conspiracy. This is now assumed. But notice also, the door is still left over. Even in 1878, racism in the future, the door is still left open, but only for a few who can do it body and soul. Never, of course, the East European Jews. Clearly, this accusation, combined with the lack of ethics, clearly this accusation combined with the idea that the Jew was a parasite, the other important linguistic accusation. The idea of parasite was borrowed from the new scientific interest of the 18th century and was transferred this time to nobody else, not to Freemasons, not to Jesuits, but straight to the Jews. A parasite has certain qualities, at least in science, and therefore in the transference. The parasite, they meant, sucked blood. That always goes together. Parasites suck blood. Parasites, in other words, suck the blood of Europe. How do they suck the blood? Well, now you come again to finance capitalism and all of that sort of thing. The Jew, therefore, is a state within a state, but it is a parasitic state. It is a parasitic state. That, I think, needs not much longer explanation. Scientific vocabulary becomes very important in all of this. Becomes important in a way, and not only important, but primary. Eventually, the Jews become the parasites, the exploiters. And that takes in a whole iceberg of meaning. For I come back to phrase, exploiters can have no categorical imperative. What does it mean? Exploiters can have no soul. Can have no soul. Can have no compassion. What does that mean? They are not human. They are in fact parasites. They are parasites in human guise, to use the contemporary 19th and 20th century formulation. They are parasites in human guise. It is clear, therefore, that we have here laid the basis of a stereotype. For the first thing about the stereotype is not only is it conspiratorial, it is also without a soul. How do you translate being without a soul into symbolism? How do you translate being without a soul, being an exploiter and parasite, into symbolism? How do you translate that into symbolism? So you can activate the masses. You can make it a mass move. Well, you do it by putting forward an idea of ugliness. What sort of an idea of ugliness? An idea of ugliness that contrasts with the prevalent ideal of beauty. What was the prevalent ideal of beauty? Here I go back to the Enlightenment again. The idea of beauty of the 19th century, and I'm now talking about human beauty, the idea of human beauty came from the classical revival. Came from the classical revival. The beautiful human being was something that some of you call yourselves anyway, a Greek god. You still say that, don't you? I do. I'm as beautiful as a Greek god.
How do you know?
Well, you went for a lovely holiday. Ah! The idea of beauty, therefore, is a great idea of beauty. One is the stereotype, the opposite. So that what we must come to now is a consideration of beauty and ugliness and the Jew. Beauty and the beast, beauty and the Jew. Very important. Very important. Why? Because from what I have said, I hope you have gathered one thing, that mass politics is aesthetic politics. That the center of mass politics is symbolism. And symbolisms mean ideas of beauty and ugliness. That all modern politics is aesthetic politics. That the kind of stereotype to which we come, will be a political act, just as the Negro stereotype in America is a political thing. So the Jewish stereotype, as it grows up, is a political thing, matching with this mass anti-Semitism. To that, I shall go next time. Friday discussion.